Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
I'm the second host, Aaron Maté. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for being here. Your one-stop shop for all the useful idiocy you need in your life. You get bonus content, including extended interviews and the Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. And there's so much madness right now as we count down to the election, I guess, of a lifetime. Every election is always the election that will decide the fate of the world. Yeah. And this one, I guess, is no different. Donald J. Trump versus Kamala Harris. We're all on the edge of our seats. Who, you know, as a show that's really been covering the genocide in Gaza extensively, you know, both candidates competing to see who can be more genocidal. It's a really, really exciting. And what a show to the world of what kind of country we are, that the top of the ticket, everyone's pro-genocide and competing to see who's more on board with it.
Right. So those of you out there who are enjoying this genocide, the good news is that nothing will change under either of them.
As Joe Biden promised his wealthy donors back in 2020, nothing will fundamentally change.
Although, to be fair, as some people have pointed out, it could get worse, but it definitely there will be nothing inspiring, nothing moral, nothing righteous, nothing life-saving that will happen.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to amend a view I've been expounding, which is that I don't think it could possibly get worse than Joe Biden. But you know what? It can always get worse. You're right. It can. So it's even possible that Donald Trump, when it comes to this issue of mass murder, could be worse. But it's also conceivable, given how bad that Joe Biden has been, that he'd be better. Who knows?
Right.
Who knows? But it's true. We can't rule out the possibility, as grim as it is, that things could get worse.
Right. Just more I mean, literally, you know, I understand when people say that, when they say, how could it get worse? There's already a genocide. And I totally understand that. And it's true. There's already a genocide. I think the scary thing is that there could be a genocide that kills more people.
These are the grim possibilities we have to deal with in 2024.
Yeah. Democracy in action, guys. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's turn to our four basic food groups. I have Democrats suck. So let's turn to how Kamala Harris is making a pitch to voters in the home stretch. And if you're running a tight race and you're running against Donald J. Trump, then why not bring out the most celebrated family in America? Everybody loves the home run hitters, the Cheneys. Yes, Kamala Harris is hitting the battlegrounds with the Cheneys, including Michigan, where they sat down for a town hall. And let's hear some of their deep thoughts on the state of the world, where, according to Kamala Harris and Liz Cheney, they are totally aligned. So here's Kamala Harris on why she thinks voters should vote for her and the Cheney agenda of foreign policy.
When we got attacked, Pearl Harbor, we jumped in. And it is because America jumped in that we were ultimately able to win that war. And it should be a constant reminder to us. We have to remember history, that isolationism, which is exactly what Donald Trump is pushing, pull out of NATO, abandon our friends. Isolationism is not insulation. It is not insulation. It will not insulate us.
Wow. Those are fiery words. Isolation is not insulation. I can see that just catching fire across the country. People are going to be turning out now with that mantra in their heads. Oh, yeah. Isolation is not insulation. That just really rolls off the tongue, and it speaks to everyone's top concerns right now.
Isolation never. Insulation now.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This isn't the Cold War anymore. Like, you know, there was a strand a long time ago called isolationism, people who just, you know, wanted to not be so involved around the world. But like, I know that like for someone like Liz Cheney, the concept of isolationism still fires them up, but it's just not something that's really going to resonate with most people who are struggling to pay the bills.
You know, I have slightly, this is a unusual moment. I have a little bit of a different take from you, Aaron, on this, in that I think that they are out of touch. They're hawkish and they're cold warriors and they want a new cold war. But I think that, you know, what Kamala is doing here, and the irony is that if Kamala herself weren't such a hawk, she could make a very effective argument against Donald Trump. Because the truth is, Donald Trump is not an isolationist. He pretends to be an isolationist. And Aaron, you've pointed this out many times, that when he ran in 2016, he ran as an anti-war candidate. But then, of course, he hires someone like John Bolton. But I think that, you know, Trump does try to lean into isolationism, although he's not actually an isolationist. And I think that the scary thing about what Kamala Harris is saying is that, you know, name one war besides World War II where we were on the right side. I can't think of any. So it's convenient for her to point to that war as an example of why we should be more interventionist. And I do think it was right, obviously, to fight in World War II against the Nazis. But every single other time we've done something militarily, we've been wrong.
Yeah, sure. I'm just saying it's like the concept of isolationism. It's a Cold War trope that's just not really going to land with most people. And also, yes, Trump, this whole thing about Trump threatening to pull out of NATO. Yeah, Trump talked about it, but what did he actually do? He got NATO to spend more money on its military, and he bragged about that. And Democrats, for whatever reason, don't want to focus on the issues where I think they just have much more of an appeal to average people, namely with, like, you know, they are closer to unions, although they're not great, obviously, when it comes to workers' rights. And but they have done more things for average people, like in terms of fighting for better wages and lowering the price of prescription drugs. Like, those are the things where, and also their stance on abortion. Those, I think, are on top of where I think they're actually better. They're also just winning issues. But instead, they're determined to win over this mythical neocon voter who's like concerned about isolationism.
Right.
That outside of MSNBC green rooms, I don't think really even exists. And why elevate Liz Cheney and the Cheneys and her father for that? I don't know, but that's what they seem intent on doing. And let's hear from Liz Cheney herself about why Kamala Harris is her preferred pick for president.
I tell people often, you know, I spend a lot of time working on national security issues. And when people that I know in the Republican Party tell me they might be considering voting for Trump from a national security perspective, I ask them, go look at his national security policies. Please go look at them. Because what he's proposing in terms of...
They were your policies, Liz Cheney. They were everything you wanted. He bombed Syria multiple times. He tried to overthrow the government of Venezuela, imposed murderous sanctions that crippled the economy. He imposed so-called maximum pressure on Iran, walking away from diplomacy. He supported
Cuba sanctions.
He undid what Obama tried to do in opening up to Cuba a little bit by, you know, imposing starvation sanctions on Cuba. He recognized Israel's theft of the Golan Heights. He, you know, recognized Israel's conquest of Jerusalem by moving the capital there. And he did all these things that neocons love. But Liz Cheney, because I think there's a personal animus that Trump embarrassed the Bush dynasty, which her father was obviously integral to. And also because he's too much of a loudmouth, doesn't like how ugly he makes the empire look. So that's her issue here. And Democrats playing along with it.
Well, no, I just think that the irony again is that I think that people do actually identify as isolationists, and they are doing Trump a favor by pretending he's an isolationist.
Well, certainly that helped him out in 2016. And they seem determined to repeat those mistakes.
Yeah.
Here's someone, though, who remembers 2016, and not only 2016, but also the Bush years. The Bush years, which were shaped by the very same Cheney family that Kamala Harris is campaigning with. And that's Jon Stewart, who asked Tim Walz, Kamala Harris's running mate, about why is the Kamala Harris campaign campaigning with Liz Cheney?
The Cheney thing. Do we really have to do that?
Look, it goes broader than that. Look, Bernie Sanders, Dick Cheney, Taylor Swift.
No.
Having the Cheneys on board?
Nah. You can't Dick Cheney or Taylor Swift. Nah.
We're a big tent.
What country did Taylor Swift get us to invade? No.
Yeah. No, don't don't you think, though, that, and I do this, I believe this,
yeah,
there is still a core group of folks out there, you know, your point being, and not joke, that the don't tread on me, the Reagan piece of this, the libertarian piece, but the constitutional piece.
Yes.
There are a lot of people out there. I think.
I'm sorry. You know, from what I understand of libertarians, the Cheneys are not speaking to them. The libertarians are supposed to be anti-war, actually. They're right. Supposed to be isolationists. But anyway, that's a side note. Back to Tim Walz.
Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney give permission to those folks who want to find a reason to do the right thing. It doesn't mean they agree with us. We're not going to take their foreign policy decisions and discussions, you know, and implement those. We're going to take their
promise.
Yes, promise.
Yeah. So there you go. That's interesting from Tim Walz feeling compelled to stress. I've never heard another Democrat say this, that we're not going to take the foreign policy advice of the Cheneys. That's not what Kamala Harris is saying, though.
Right.
She's up there with Liz Cheney bragging about how they're in sync when it comes to foreign policy. So I appreciate that effort by Tim Walz, and I wish he was right. And if he is right, great. But I don't think he is, unfortunately. It looks to me like they are taking foreign policy advice from the Cheneys.
Right. I know. I wonder if he got an angry phone call from Kamala Harris.
I wouldn't be surprised. And a bonus Democrat suck. And it's so bonus that we're even wearing different clothing to bring it to you. But we just thought this clip was so Democrat sucky that we had to break in and share it with you.
We'd be remiss not to. We'd be shirking our journalistic responsibilities.
Absolutely. We'd be shirking. So that's why we put on different shirting.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Oh, my
Thank
God. You. Aaron, I feel like I've rubbed off on you.
You definitely have. So here's Kamala Harris doing a town hall with CNN. And, you know, an issue that comes up for people who aren't yet committed to voting for her is like the whole genocide thing. Like, hey, if we vote for you, can you maybe stop the genocide that is being enabled with our tax dollars? And this is Kamala Harris's latest pitch to those voters.
What do you say to voters who are thinking about supporting a third party candidate or staying on the couch, not voting at all because of this issue?
Listen, I am not going to deny the strong feelings that people have. I don't know that anyone who has seen the images who would not have strong feelings about what has happened, much less those who have relatives who have died and been killed. And I know people and have talked with people.
That's her bid right now to reach out to voters in Michigan, where she might lose not only the state, but the election because she supports the genocide, because there's a lot of Arab Americans, Muslim Americans in Michigan. So she's trying to acknowledge the fact that they exist.
Right. She hears them. She sees them.
Yeah, she sees them.
So I appreciate that. But I also do know that for many people who care about this issue, they also care about bringing down the price of groceries. They also care about our democracy and not having a president of the United States who admires dictators and is a fascist. They also care about the fact that we need practical, common sense solutions from a leader who is willing to work across the aisle on behalf of the American people and not themselves. They want a president who cares about a fundamental freedom to make decisions about your own body, understanding that we're not trying to change anyone's belief, but let's not have the government telling women what to do with their body.
Okay, so yeah, I hear you. I see you. You're against genocide and you're mad at my administration for supporting it. But do you want your grocery prices to go up? You know what I mean?
Also, doesn't she realize she's actually bringing up an argument for the financial reasons besides the moral ones to not be supporting a genocide? Like, this is actually one of the arguments that anti-genocide people make to try to reach more apathetic people. Like, it's actually not good for your pocketbook that we're spending all this money on Israel's genocidal war.
Yeah, well, she's so not willing to cut the funding for that genocidal war that she's trying to make an appeal to you based on other things you might care about, like higher groceries and abortion. Right. And, you know, those are real concerns, but she's not addressing the fact that people are against genocide and she's refusing to, I guess. And, you know, if I were her, if you're not going to change anything about Biden's policy, at least try to make the argument that Trump could be worse than Biden, which, you know, I think is actually a real prospect. So, you know, she could try to say, hey, you know, Trump has done this for Israel. He recognized the embassy in Jerusalem. He recognized Israel's death, the Golan Heights. He's vowing to be even more aggressive in backing up Israel against Iran. She could do that. But the problem is there. She just doesn't want to show any daylight between her and Trump and supporting Israel because she's that committed to showing pro-Israel donors that she's on their side. So
right.
It's just the choice is just as we just keep saying, it's just, it's very depressing.
It's so hard to stay remotely positive during this time. I mean, it's just so dystopian. And people are going to look back on this period in a way that they've looked back at other genocides and said, what were you doing? Were you speaking out? How could people let this happen?
All right. That's been your bonus Democrat suck. Now let's turn to our regular program.
Speaking of how we have two atrocious choices when it comes to the issue of Palestine, for Republican suck, let's take a look at what Donald Trump had to say about Netanyahu.
Talked to Prime Minister Netanyahu about it.
He's called me, yes. He's called me. I have not spoken. I'm going to speak to him probably now.
What are you going to tell him?
Well, look, he's doing a good job. Biden is trying to hold him back. Just so you understand, Biden is far superior to the VP. He's trying to hold him back, and he probably should be doing the opposite, actually. I'm glad that VP decided to do what he had to do, but it's moving along pretty good.
So in case you had any trouble hearing, because he was near some kind of airplane or helicopter, he said, he's called me, Bibi's doing a good job, Biden is trying to hold him back. And then he says that he's far superior to Kamala Harris and probably should be doing the opposite. I'm glad that Bibi decided to do what he had to do. So here again, ironically, we see the politician, the nominee, actually helping the enemy. Because as we just saw with Kamala and Liz Cheney pretending, acting like Donald Trump is an isolationist, which is something he likes to pretend. To some extent, Kamala Harris is pretending that she's more, that she's better on Palestine and Israel than Biden is. Now, we know the truth is she's not. She may be better at like optics or at sound bites, but you have Trump basically helping her make her case that she's better on this. But the more significant thing, or equally significant, or as significant, is the fact that Trump is actually saying that Bibi's doing a good job and he's doing what he has to do.
They're just competing to see who can be more genocidal. And, you know, on the Democratic side, you had Richie Torres go to Michigan recently and brag that Kamala Harris wouldn't even let a Palestinian American speaker on stage, even though there's a huge Arab American and Muslim population in Michigan that will probably decide the state and possibly the election. But they just, Democrats don't want it. And certainly, you know, Trump's been making a pitch to Muslim voters. And in fact, he seized on the fact that Liz Cheney is campaigning with Kamala Harris and pointed out that the Cheneys were responsible for, you know, killing so many people in Iraq. And that's Trump's pitch. But meanwhile, he turns around and talks about how Benjamin Netanyahu shouldn't be held back. So it's just such a, if you're against genocide, you really, between these two candidates, there's no choice. There's no good choice.
All right. So what do we got for Isn't That Weird?
For Isn't That Weird, let's continue on with the theme of just ghoulish statements about Palestine. This is Douglas Murray. Made his name as kind of like a atheist, right? You know, he's against like religious fundamentalism. And it turns out, of course, the only religious fundamentalism he doesn't like is Muslim. Now, when it comes to defending the self-declared Jewish state, he's a hardcore fundamentalist to the point where he borders on just outright racism. I mean, at every turn. So here, for example, is him talking recently about the importance of Israel to Western civilization.
What is being attempted by Israel's enemies is the philosophical and cultural equivalent of burning all the libraries of Alexandria. This is one of the underpinnings of Western civilization, utterly, utterly at risk. And not in a sort of metaphorical way where people might use it as a sort of book subtitle, but of the real thing. I mean, I've sometimes thought about it this way. I haven't tried this out in public before. How many Jews are there in the world?
15 million.
15 million. Okay. This is going to come. This may come across really coarse, but let me put it this way. I mean, there are lots of conflicts in the world, and I've covered a lot of conflicts involving a lot of people. But it's conceivable that at some point, 15 million Christians could be killed. It would be a disaster, a tragedy. It's conceivable that at some point, Burma, India, somewhere, 15 million Muslims could be killed. It would be a disaster. It would be a tragedy of an unimaginable scale, of mid-20th century scale. But if 15 million Jews were killed, that's the end of the story.
Douglas Murray is saying that the survival of a Jewish supremacist state, because that's what it is, that's not controversial anymore. Israel is a fundamentalist state where Jews have superior rights to the indigenous people of the land. Everybody knows that now. He's saying that the survival of Western civilization depends on Israel's survival. So what he's saying is that, like, he sees, you know, Western, so-called Westerners, which Jews are included, as superior to everybody else. That's what he's saying. That, like, and it wouldn't matter if like 15 million Muslims died, whatever, but we can't have 15 million Jews die and Israel along with it, because then Western civilization wouldn't survive. So he's basically a Nazi. That's what he's essentially saying. It's a Nazi point of view. And he's somehow yet taken seriously as an intellectual and as an atheist when he's just a flat out supremacist who takes way too long to make the point.
Yeah, I know. Seriously.
I mean, let's get to the point here. Just come out and say you're a supremacist.
Also, it's like undoes. I mean, imagine how stupid he'd sound without the English accent taking that long to make those points.
Well, I'm not an English accent supremacist, so I don't think he sounds any smarter.
I don't like to be. I think subconsciously many of us are, but either way, and that's something I need to check, my own English accent supremacy. But, you know, it's just so rich to hear him talking about libraries as Israel is like burning down every academic institution in Gaza right now. Committing scholasticide. This guy who really cares about intellectual culture.
And by the way, you know, like in terms of civilization, like the cradle of civilization is in the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, it's in Baghdad, it's in Damascus. He's just such a Western supremacist that for him it's Athens, Greece, and it's also, you know, Jerusalem under Jewish control, even though, of course, Jerusalem has been shared by all the religions forever, you know, and, the so-called Jewish state came along in the last century to steal it for everybody else, you know, but unfortunately that is a peek into where Western civilization is at right now. It reminds me of the quote attributed to Gandhi, who said, you know, who's asked about what he thought about Western civilization. And he said, I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Right. And of course, if he cared about, I mean, the irony is also Al-Andalus, that period was one of a lot of intellectual flourishing. And that was a, under, you know, an Islamic rule, a very tolerant one, one that emphasized coexistence. But I'm sure it's interesting he leaves that out, that period. So for Isn't That Terrible, I have a shifting gears a little bit. Let's take a look at the always great for news source, the New York Post. And here's the headline: SeaWorld Orca splashes poop-filled water at horrified audience. Quote, that was personal. Okay, so what happened is tourists at SeaWorld San Antonio didn't expect the Orca Splash Zone to feature a wave of killer whale fecal matter. And so what happened was there was an orca that jumped into its glass and sprayed them after taking a big poop. So I guess the correct order is that the orca was swimming around, made a deposit, and then splashed it all over people. And it was captured on TikTok. And people are very upset about it, obviously.
If you're going, where is that? SeaWorld?
Yeah.
If you're going to SeaWorld, I mean, you're in the world of the sea. So, you know, these things happen in the sea. So why not go for the authentic experience?
It's also a pretty unfair thing to do to animals, is put them in SeaWorld. So maybe that's kind of like vengeance.
If you're going to cage someone, then they're going to still have to do their bodily functions. And so you have to pay the price of it. So, you know, I think it's the price of admission to be splashed with poop water.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's right. That guy who said in the audience that was personal.
Damn right. It's personal.
Yeah.
If you're going to trap a whale at SeaWorld, then you better be prepared for Sea Poop World. You know,
nice. I like it. Sea Poop World. Thank you. Yeah. And those have been your four basic food groups. If you ask some of our haters, they tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots, you know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant, and since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the no BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant Magazine. While most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right. Betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up. Only with MyBookie.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
For this week's guest, we are joined by Elijah Magnier. He is a journalist with more than 35 years of experience covering the Middle East and North Africa. We get into a lot today, including the latest in Israeli aggression in Lebanon and Gaza, and also who he thinks would be worse for the Middle East, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, which is a choice that is about to be decided with the upcoming U.S. election.
We also ask him about the very disturbing news that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have just published a list of six Al Jazeera journalists who they are accusing of being either Islamic Jihad terrorists or connected to Hamas. And this, of course, is basically a kill list.
Yeah. To add to the journalists in Gaza, the Israel has killed by the dozens so far. Now they're trying to put six brave people with Al Jazeera on that list. So we talk about that and a whole lot more. Here is Elijah Magnier. Elijah Magnier, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with Lebanon, a country you've been covering for a very long time. What is your assessment of where things are right now in the battle between Israel and Hezbollah?
I think the Israelis underestimated what remains of Hezbollah's forces. Israel fought by killing the Secretary General, destroying the operational room in Beirut, killing the head of the operation room, many of the Jihadi Council members, that oversee the various military units and triggering the sabotage attack on the pager and on ICOM. They thought that would be enough to defeat Hezbollah, as the defense minister Yoav Gallant said. However, they did not take into the account that the ground forces, the special forces, and the forces that are related to the infantry in every village have not entered the battle since the 7th of October. In fact, only the missile units were engaged with the Israeli from the 8th of October and for 11 and a half months. And the special forces have never fired one single bullet against the Israelis until the Israelis decided to push the five units along the borders. And this is where they were surprised. Secondly, Israel thought that they have destroyed the strategic missiles that Hezbollah has, not taking into the account that they have destroyed a large number of these missiles that exist above the ground. And they omitted those which are under the ground, and the resupply capability of Hezbollah, even during the war, that we have seen also happening in 2006. And all this miscalculation blocked five divisions, Division 210, 98, 91, 36, 146, along 100 kilometers, freezing them, making them, their advance extremely difficult for them to come in and take high ground or occupy hills or occupy a village and then remain in it. That is the key. So what I see here is that the Israelis are really thinking again, is the invasion is a good idea? Secondly, and last, the point is that Israel failed to occupy 364 square kilometers in Gaza, setting an objective to occupy 5 kilometers per 100, that's 500 square kilometers, in the south of Lebanon against an adversary like Hezbollah is really beyond Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's dream or expectation.
Yet Israel continues to bomb from afar, hitting civilian infrastructure. Some of the latest targets by Israel inside Lebanon include a community bank that is tied to Hezbollah, also Al-Mayadeen, a television network. Talk to us about Israel's strategy of targeting civilian sites in a bid to, you know, sow division in Lebanese society and put pressure on Hezbollah from within Lebanon.
The mistake that Israel did is the fact that bombing the south of Lebanon, forcing the inhabitant to be displaced internally, and doing exactly the same in the Bekaa Valley for the first time in 2006. We have not seen this kind of destruction in the Bekaa Valley, but that has a reason. And also in the suburb of Beirut, then the entire Hezbollah society that Hezbollah is part of and the society that protects Hezbollah is already displaced. Therefore, Hezbollah doesn't have any more anything to be afraid of and to fear for society to be displaced, because this is what Israel did in the first week of the beginning of the attack on Lebanon. That gave more freedom for Hezbollah to attack the Israelis and to create a deterrence. Now, we have to admit that Israel did not bomb directly any civilian objective, and I will explain. Anything that Israel knows that is related to Hezbollah, it has presented the excuse this is financed or linked to Hezbollah. They did not go to target deliberately, apart from many collateral damage that took place, a specific civilian target. One could argue that there are more than 125 now buildings in the south of, in the suburb of Beirut, that have been destroyed. But Hezbollah's presence in every building with a small office or a civilian institution is enough for the Israeli to say Well, we've targeted this building that is full of civilians, homes who have fled the place. And because of the presence of Hezbollah, we've targeted it. This is what Hezbollah accepted as a rule of engagement. And this is why Hezbollah is not targeting civilians in Israel, in Haifa or Tel Aviv.
Let me put you the criticism that we hear in, you know, NATO state media about Hezbollah from within Lebanon, voices from Lebanon that are featured, they're critical of Hezbollah. And the critique is basically that, you know, Hezbollah has not been able to successfully resist Israel. It's part of the axis of resistance, but it intervened on October 8th in a bit of solidarity with Gaza, but it hasn't stopped the genocide in Gaza. And now it's just gotten Lebanon involved and Lebanon's civilians are paying the price. What is your response to that criticism?
Following the 7th of October, the vice head of Hamas, Saleh al-Aruri, came to Lebanon. And he had a meeting with Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the secretary of Hezbollah. And the first meeting, al-Aruri asked Sayyid Nasrallah why Hezbollah did not come in fully involved in this war. There were two parts of this answer. The first was Hezbollah was not informed, therefore not prepared, and had no word to say about the feasibility of such an attack and if Hezbollah can be part of it or not, depending on the domestic issues, the regional dynamic, and also Hezbollah's capability to start being engaged against Israel. And the second most important point, the question was put to al-Aruri, asking him if Hezbollah intervene in this war immediately, will Israel stop attacking Gaza? And al-Aruri said no. Therefore, what Hezbollah thought, and there are many miscalculations by the Palestinian resistance, by the Israelis, and by Hezbollah in this war, many made mistakes in their calculations in different aspects. Hezbollah thought that supporting Gaza is enough to keep a third of the Israeli army engaged on the Lebanese borders, and that Israel will not start an all-out war on Lebanon. And in fact, Israel miscalculated the fact that all its sabotage attack and the killing of the Secretary General and the destruction of what for Israel seems to be the strategic weapons was enough to destroy 70% of Hezbollah's capability, as the defense minister Yoav Gallant said. And that was another miscalculation of Israel, and this is why Israel started an all-out war on Lebanon. That was not in the account of Hezbollah.
So would you agree then that Hezbollah miscalculated in thinking that Israel would not start an all-out war with Lebanon?
Yes, in this term, yes, Hezbollah, as Hamas miscalculated the reaction of Israel, the support, the unlimited support of the US, Europe, the UK in particular, and all the Western community to Benjamin Netanyahu and allowing him to commit crimes against humanity, war crimes, destroy Gaza, attack all the civilian institutions, demonize the Palestinians, that was not calculated. 42 plus Palestinian killed. I don't think Hamas would have started this. And during my talk with Hamas leaders asking this question, the answer was always, it is not the time to talk about it now. The Israelis also miscalculated the Iranian response when they bombed the consulate in Damascus, never thought that Iran will go and attack Israel the first time and the second time after assassinating Ismail Haniyeh. Otherwise, Israel would never have bombed the location in Damascus or attack Haniyeh in Tehran. The miscalculation of Hezbollah underestimating the breach in certain level of intelligence gathering that Israel managed to locate all the places where Hezbollah has an office or warehouses or shelters or operational room, and sabotage the pager was also that, not taking into account that Israel would go and target more than 6,000 objectives in a few days, destroy them. Although I've said repeatedly before the beginning that Hezbollah has 13,000 targets to destroy before the attack, but nobody thought that among these 13,000 targets would be also the strategic missiles and to go and assassinate Sayyid Nasrallah himself.
You know, when it comes to miscalculation, this reminds me of what Nasrallah reportedly said about the 2006 war. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, so Hezbollah back then launches a cross-border incursion to capture some Israeli soldiers in a bid to get Hezbollah captives freed by Israel. And Israel responds not by negotiating, but by going on a scorched earth campaign in Lebanon and causing massive destruction, especially against civilian areas. And apparently, and correct me if I'm wrong, Nasrallah said, if I had known Israel would have gone this crazy, I never would have authorized this. You know, and I'm curious your thoughts on that and what you think Nasrallah took away from that experience in 2006.
Excellent question. And thank you for the opportunity to explain it, because so far nobody spoke about it. The answer from Sayyid Nasrallah did not come about the military confrontation with Israel, but because of the level of destruction of civilian houses that Israel inflicted on the Lebanese society. I lived in 2006 in Dahi for 33 days. Well, no, to be accurate, 31. I came out when it was agreed of a ceasefire, and we all know militarily when there is a ceasefire, the last 2 days, everybody empty their arsenal against the objective, so you better get out of the way. And I've seen the level of destruction that I have never seen before in my entire life, covering more than a dozen of war zones. And this level of destruction was not expected by Hezbollah. Hezbollah thought that the Israelis will be angry and bomb a little bit south of Lebanon, and then they will have to sit around the table and negotiate. And in fact, the Israelis did not want to go to war at that time. And it was the project of Condoleezza Rice, of a new Middle East, that pushed the Israeli unprepared to a war. So also that is a miscalculation on both sides, but for different reasons. But this time is different. This time, Hezbollah started to support Gaza, to support the Palestinian people, and accepted in the first few months the destruction of more than 60 villages along the borders. And Hezbollah tried to conduct a clean war by inviting the Israelis to bomb only the villages within 5 to 10 kilometers, because the first bomb that Hezbollah launched was actually not against Israel. They were against all the territories that were occupied by the Israelis, Lebanese territories. And then the Israeli expanded to 7 to 10 kilometers, and Hezbollah followed the Israelis. And then the Israelis were violating the rule of engagement, hitting in the Bekaa Valley, in Nabatieh, in close to Sidon, violating this rule, but was acceptable for Hezbollah to continue as long as the fight is within limits, certain limits. And because Sayyid Nasrallah is a truthful man and the Israelis believe him, when he said to the Israelis that he can bomb and destroy Tel Aviv, he was right. Had Israel did not destroy a large number of ballistic missiles that Hezbollah has. Nevertheless, Hezbollah is showing in the last few days a new precision missile that Hezbollah did not speak about, but he spoke about a new missile. But I know that these are the Fatah 110M that are very precise within 1 to 3 meters that the Israelis are aware of. The Israelis understand that every single day they go beyond the limit and bomb Dahye. Hezbollah is launching missiles against Tel Aviv. So again here, the miscalculation came from Israel not being aware that 1 million people in Haifa would go to the shelter every day, and 3.5 million in Tel Aviv when Israel bombed the suburb. Then also Hezbollah is going to target Tel Aviv. So the reason why I'm saying that, in war, nobody knows what the outcome is going to be and how far this is going to go. And this is where we can call it as miscalculation. However, the consequences are unforeseen by both sides.
It seems like Israel makes miscalculations and there are these kind of surprising victories on the part of Hezbollah and Hamas, but nothing will stop Israel. I mean, it seems like Israel is just unstoppable. I want to know what you think Israel's ultimate game plan is, what their ultimate goal is.
Israel today is in a real dilemma. First, Hamas has been weakened. That is true. But we haven't seen the white flag so far. We've seen the Israeli going 3 times to Jabalia, 7 times to Khan Yunis, pushing a division in Rafah, and telling us that they have defeated 20 battalions, still only 4, went to Rafah and then went back to Khan Yunis and then went again to Jabalia. And then the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, saying Hamas is recruiting every time that we go out. Hamas is recruiting thousands of new militant with volunteers that joining Hamas. And then Hamas is using the unlimited bombs, unexploded, that are in Gaza. If the Americans have given the Israelis 50,000 tons of explosive, and according to the Israelis, 20% of these have not exploded, this is where Hamas is using the same weapons, American weapons, against the Israelis. So we still see fighting there in small groups, but enough for the Israelis not to feel comfortable in remaining in Gaza. In Lebanon, it's completely different. We're talking about around 80,000 men, more modern, modernly equipped, much bigger than the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. And they have electronic warfare, they have bombs that are very precise. In 1982, they didn't have that. They can launch missiles from afar. They have the Merkava 4 tank with a trophy that is can intercept laser-guided missile. All that with several hundreds of tanks, and they're not capable in 4 weeks to break into Hezbollah's line, which is inevitable. But the problem is, can they stay in? And the Israelis are realizing that they cannot remain there. Because imagine, Hezbollah is firing between 150 to 200 rockets, missiles, and drones every day on Israel. Well, forget about Israel and just imagine these falling on all the Israeli troops in south of Lebanon. That wouldn't last 48 hours. So this dilemma of miscalculating the strength of Hezbollah, the resilience, and the still intact force of the special forces and the infantry is something that Benjamin Netanyahu did not take into account.
And can you talk about the effect of the assassinations of Nasrallah and Sinwar on the resistance movements? And also, you mentioned that you were in contact with Hamas. Can you talk about your relationship with them and what you've been, how you've been communicating with them?
I've been in different places in the Middle East where I talked to their representative that are officially present in Qatar, Doha, and they are willing to talk to people because they want to explain what's happening. They have press conferences with journalists, etc. And to answer your question about the Sinwar first and then Sayyid Nasrallah second, we've seen Sinwar with 2 people in Rafah, and we've seen him conducting a response to the attack he was under from the Israelis when they localized him, why they were attacked in Jabalia, and Israel saying that they've lost many men there, even including a colonel in his armed vehicle. Therefore, the groups like Hamas are decentralized. Every single area, if we take only half of the north, from Jabalia to Beit Lahia to Shate to Beit Hanun only, there you have different groups, different commands, and different command and control, different leaders who do not need to report to the general command anywhere in Gaza or outside Gaza, because these fighters know one thing, how to fight Israel, and that's their job. And this is what they have dedicated their life for, as long as the Israelis are in Gaza for the moment, for the last 12 months. So they don't really need to refer back to the central command and control to ask for instructions. They just have to fight the Israelis. It's exactly the same in Gaza City or in the Wadi Gaza or in Hamad or Khan Yunis or any part of Gaza. They are decentralized and they can fight. As Sinwar explained in his death, which was a big mistake from the Israeli to show us how he died, exactly the fight and the struggle between the Palestinians and the Israelis for the last 78 years. We've seen a wounded man on his divan, incapable of fighting. He found only a piece of wood and threw it against an advanced drone. It represents the Palestinians who don't have modern equipment, who are handicapped, are in an open concentration camp in Gaza. They are surrounded by the Israelis who dictate how much they can eat or drink, what they can construct. Before October 2023, 100,000 homes were not constructed, yes, following the war in 2021, because the Israelis limit the amount of construction that can go into Gaza. And then they're fighting a modern army, but they find what they have next to them, a piece of wood, and they throw it, knowing that this is not going to affect the Israelis. And then we have the Israeli reaction by firing from a tank to destroy it and claiming the right to defend themselves. That portrayed the 78 years of war. And the killing of Sinwar, in my opinion, I think Sinwar knew he's going to be killed in the battlefield. And this is why he accepted the leadership of Hamas, that they should no longer, in my opinion, announce who is going to be the next leader, exactly like Hezbollah doesn't need to appoint a new secretary general for the moment. And that takes me to the assassination of Sayyid Nasrallah. That was a big blow of morale to Hezbollah, that for certain, because the society that embraced Hezbollah never thought that they could lose such a personality in time of war. Or in any other time, they thought he's with them and to stay with them. However, the assassination of Sayyid Nasrallah was reflected in the battlefield where the forces confronted the Israelis when they tried to invade the south of Lebanon. Sayyid Nasrallah did not carry the weapon to fight the Israelis. He was the representative of Hezbollah. He was charismatic. People loved him. He represented a party that has a Shura Council. Since 2006, he was the absolute leader. Before 2006, there was a Shura Council that takes decisions, not one man who runs the party. Therefore, his disappearing from the organization will push Hezbollah to return to the post-2006 era, where there is a Shura Council that decides and where the collective decision is taken and people on the ground know what they have to do. Sayyid Nasrallah was powerful because of the power and the trust of the people who have the capability to stand against Israel, not to defeat Israel, but to prevent Israel from winning.
Can you talk about that distinction that you just mentioned?
Defeat Israel, Hezbollah is a non-state actor. It has not been made to start an offensive war against Israel, but to carry out a defensive position in case of Israeli attack. Hezbollah did not cross the borders, did not do like Hamas on the 7th of October. The fight was limited along the borders against the Israeli positions in Lebanese-occupied territory. And this is what the force of Hezbollah was created for, is to make sure that Israel will not have an easy life when they decide to occupy Lebanon. This is the role of Hezbollah, to prevent Israel from winning and inflict damage on Israel so they can think again and pull out. That's a distinction.
The U.S. envoy for Lebanon, Amos Hochstein, who is a former Israeli soldier born in Israel, he's been making a number of visits to Lebanon recently. He met with the parliamentary speaker, who was tied to Hezbollah's political wing, and he reportedly said that the existing framework for resolving hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah, which is UN Resolution 1701, is not enough. And he's reportedly presenting new conditions. Meanwhile, Israel has also demanded the right, as far as I understand it, to basically be allowed to attack Lebanon whenever it wants, and to expand its aggression there at its will. That's apparently what Israel has been demanding the U.S. sign off on. What's your sense of how far the U.S. is going in backing Israeli demands? And talk to us about UN Resolution 1701 and whether you think it can still provide a path to end hostilities inside, to end Israeli aggression inside Lebanon right now.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Again, very grateful to Elijah Magnier for joining us. He has so much experience covering this region, and I always learn a lot hearing from him, and today was no exception.
Yeah, it was really, really fascinating, and he has so much insight and experience. Make sure you become members at usefulidiotspodcast.com so you can hear the full interview and also hear his thoughts on who would be worse, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. And of course, as always, you get our Thursday throwdown, our midweek dose of media madness.
Thanks so much for watching, Useful Idiots. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.